Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona Kay, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And my hope is that the information shared in this podcast will help you understand the strengths, differences, and challenges in your neurodiverse relationship as you move forward in life. Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. Welcome back to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I am Mona, and I'm so glad that all of you are here to listen to this great conversation that I am going to have today with Jill Kearns from Australia. And Jill, welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast.
G'day. No, good. Just
doubt. I love that.
No, we're not all crass. We're good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world.
Thank you. Thank you. So I always like to start by having my guests share a little bit about what work they're doing now and kind of what brought them to choose that path. So if you don't mind sharing a little bit about that, that would be fantastic.
Sure. So firstly, Mona, I just wanted to say I love your authenticity. I aspire to have your authenticity and the impact on that you've had on the neurodiverse love community around the world is amazing. It certainly had and you know, I aspire to be like you. And that's what I'm going to try and do today, because I listen to a lot of your podcasts and I love the fact that you, you're just you and you expose your mess of being a human and you share that in your messages. And it's so powerful. And I really want to try and do the same today.
Awesome. I know you will. Thank you so much. I really appreciate those kind words.
So my journey is, you know, is like so many. And I think yesterday I was hearing 75% of your presenters have got a personal story. Well, mine's not terribly different, but I did listen to a lot of stories and I found some bits that other people didn't talk about that I'd probably like to focus on today because they're new bits of information, I think. Mm-hmm. But my basic story, and I've called my talk today My Neurodiverse Love, My Trauma, My Healing and My Counselling, because it's that. It's the story of my neurodiverse love, which was beautiful and is beautiful, the extreme, and I mean extreme trauma that unfortunately I suffered, but I think I know why that happened, how I managed to heal myself, which was a tough journey, but I think I'm nearly healed. Maybe I've got more to go, but I'm a long way there. And then how I use all of that information in my counseling.
Awesome. Sounds terrific. So let's start a little bit with your neurodiverse love and kind of what brought you to the place that you're at right now.
Okay. So like many of your listeners and speakers, mine is a true love story. My former husband, who's given me permission today, and not only permission, but his blessings to say everything that I want to say, which, you know, thank you so much for that. We were married for 38 years, and in many ways, we had a really fantastic marriage. We both loved and love each other to this day a great deal. We parented three children successfully. We cared for our five children successfully. We supported each other with our careers. We shared tasks. We shared money fairly. We travelled all over the world, all with very few problems. And I think from the outside, we probably look like the perfect couple in that so many of the things in our lives we did well together and we looked really good from the outside. Mm-hmm. However, and this is, you know, the bit that people are waiting for, well, how come you're divorced and things went wrong? So after about 10 years of marriage, I started to suspect that he was autistic, but quickly found that he was not willing to talk to me or anyone else about that at all. Mm-hmm. and I mean at all. And to cut a long story short, he was formally diagnosed in his early 50s. And I appreciate that if you've been autistic and masking for 50 years, it must be very, very hard to suddenly disclose and start acting autistic. It must be terribly hard to do that. And what happened was he got his formal diagnosis and he said to me, can I tear it up? And of course I said yes, and it got torn up and put in the bin. Mm-hmm. And really from that point onwards, he didn't disclose his autism to anybody. And this was the really tricky bit, including our immediate family. And I mean our children and our brothers and our sisters and our parents.
Yeah, and I think that's very common, Jill. I think it's very common. There's a lot of shame. There's a lot of questions in, you know, the person's mind. You know, how would my life have been different? How would my relationship have been different? How would my relationship with my children be different? So I hear that often from the autistic partners.
So sad yes. for both of us. And because of his wonderful skills, of which he has many, he considerably masked when in public, considerably. And, you know, he'd had 50 years to practice it, so I don't think he even thought about it. But things were very different behind closed doors. And I don't really want to go into what that was because I'm sure most of your listeners already know. Mm-hmm. Things were just different. And I suffered a lot of emotional deprivation, but I have to say in brackets, it was not deliberate. He was not deliberately emotionally depriving me. He wasn't doing any wrong, but the effect that it had on me was bad. Mm-hmm. But this wasn't really the cause of my trauma. I think the cause of my trauma was because I was unable to explain or get other people, and I mean my nearest and my dearest, my brothers, sisters, children, etc. I was unable to get anybody to believe my story.
Yeah.
And I think that was more traumatic than the emotional deprivation that was going on behind closed doors, because I really needed emotional support and I was unable to get it.
And Jill, what were people saying to you when you shared with them what you were experiencing?
I don't know what they were thinking, but you know, they would say, but you and Dan are the, I've just used his name, there you go, it's out, doesn't matter, he won't mind. People would say, but you know, you're the perfect couple, look at you, you do everything so well together. And I had to agree with that. And it was very hard for me to actually describe what was going on behind closed doors. And what I found was when people asked me, it actually traumatized me because I knew that I was unable to explain it and it would all come out as a mess, as a blubber and distressing mess. And so when they asked me, it traumatized me and I couldn't get the words out to tell them. And what I learned about was something called the Broca's area of the brain, and it's a part of the brain, and I'm no brain surgeon, so I'm going to describe this as a complete layperson, is that when you're traumatized, the Broca's area of the brain, which is a language part of the brain, goes offline. And what I discovered was that when I was trying to tell people what was going on, my Broca's area was going offline. And I would become a bubbling mess, couldn't even remember the story, couldn't give examples. And that added to what I felt was them just thinking that I was a nutcase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hear that from a lot of the non-autistic neurotypical partners. And for those folks that are autistic that are listening to this, you know, there's so much unintentional hurt and pain that goes on in neurodiverse relationships. That's the reality of the situation. It's not because, you know, a partner wants to hurt somebody they love, but because we don't understand each other's neurotypes and we don't understand why we're having so many challenges and differences in our relationship, these things can go on for years and years and years and years and end in divorce or the end of a relationship. And then if one or both partners finds out that they are neurodivergent, it can explain so much, but the trauma is real and it's for both partners. It's just a
Oh,
different kind of trauma, you know?
absolutely. And I think, you know, my husband's trauma was significant, but he maybe because of alexithymia wasn't able to show it in the way that I did, and he would flight, he would leave the room, whereas I would cry and scream and make a lot of noise and generally look like someone who was off their face.
I
Really.
hear you. Been there, Jill.
Yes, it sucks. But so you know, so I think we caused each other a lot of relationship trauma, and it was because we really didn't understand what was happening. And I've just said here, if we'd had a neurodiverse couples counselor 10, 20, or 30 years ago, we would definitely still be together in neurodiverse love. Definitely. And so sad that we didn't. But you know, but we didn't. And you know, this is why I'm doing what I do now. And then, you know, the last part of the story is, and it's a really sad, sad part too. During the 38th year of our marriage, after retiring, and retiring is another subject in itself that probably needs addressing because it definitely amplified our issues because we were together too much. We had an event that completely broke my trust in my former husband in 10 minutes. And it was related to the masking, but I felt that it left me in a position of being completely alone and feeling, and I'm going to say the word feeling again, feeling excluded from my immediate family. Now, I don't think my family was excluding me, but it felt like I was being pushed out of the tribe and not welcomed back in. And that was horrendous. And it happened in a space of 10 minutes. And it was just a terribly distressing 10 minutes for the whole family. And I felt so horribly betrayed at the time, although I'm not sure he was betraying me, but that's how I felt. That I was unable to repair and regain trust ever again. And I could no longer stay in our marriage and I left. I just left. It was just like, well, this is the end. And I can't stay because the pain of staying is so great that I have to leave. But you know, the pain of leaving was pretty damn great too. And when I think now, I think, you know, what I needed that day was emotional and physical safety and care from my nearest and dearest. And on that day, that could not be achieved. And I left feeling totally alone.
Can we stop there for just a second and kind of talk about that a little bit? Because I just felt in my body some feelings that I haven't felt for a while. Because as you shared what you needed in that moment, and that in literally 10 minutes everything changed and you knew you had to leave the relationship. I was already out of my marriage when a break in trust and a challenging situation happened with my extended family, not my biological family, but my ex-husband's extended family. And literally within 5 to 10 minutes, I lost them all. And they decided to cut me off. And yeah, so my, when you said what you said, my heart kind of stopped for a second. And so my heart goes out to you. And I, for those people that are listening who have had this situation with either their autistic partner or the non-autistic partner, where literally you've been cut out of the family, know you're not alone. Know that. And know that, you know, at least Jill and I in this conversation are saying we understand that pain and that deprivation and that. You know, that you could love people that much, and then in, you know, the flip of a finger, those relationships are over. And it's devastating. It's just devastating.
And so lonely.
Yes.
And you know, for that moment, Mona, and I'm just going to share my message just straight out, it would have been far easier for me to suicide than feel the pain that I did. Mm. And that's how painful. Thank goodness I didn't.
Yeah.
Thank goodness I had some foresight to think if I suicided, what would it do to my family? But the pain that I was in, it would have been far easier for me just to have finished my life, because I had to leave, and I left feeling, in my words, pushed out of the tribe. But I don't think my family were pushing me out. That's just how I felt.
Yeah. So I want to, again, I this is a very emotional topic for me too.
Yes, sure.
And yeah, I can only imagine, you know, some of the listeners hearing that and being able to relate, because the pain you feel when you love people and they don't understand you or you don't understand them, and when people can literally cut you out of their life forever, or what feels like forever, you feel like there's no way to move forward.
No.
And it's devastating. It's absolutely devastating. So
yeah.
I hear you, and I'm sending you just grace and, you know, support, because the pain is real. It's really real. Yeah.
Mona, thank you. The pain's gone, but I want to share it with other people, because I'm sure there's other people out there today who are feeling that excruciating level of pain and not knowing what to do. And my advice is, you know, just hang in for a little bit longer. Listen to someone who's gone through it, and that's what I'm hoping today, and actually survived. You know, and not only did I survive, but I've actually thrived.
Yeah.
I did it. It was damned hard work, but I did it so other people can do it too. So if you're really on your knees in the gutter, remember what Mona and I are saying, and try and pick yourself up, follow the suggestions that we're giving you. You can get there, and you can thrive.
Absolutely, Jill. I would not have thought that I would be where I am today when that happened, and, you know, even when the divorce happened. And I am the best version of myself. And like you said, I'm just not surviving. I am thriving. But believe me, you know, just like you said, there were nights, there were days that I was on the ground, literally not able to get up, crying hysterically, and wondering, you know, what was going to pull me out of this so that I could heal. Yeah, absolutely.
I found a really lovely quote from Bessel van der Kolk from the book that's often talked about, The Body Keeps a Score. And I thought this was really, I've written it down, trauma almost invariably involves not being seen, not being heard, and not being taken into account. Being able to feel safe with other people is probably the single most aspect of mental health. For our physiology to calm down, we need a feeling of safety. And I had lost all feeling of safety.
Yeah. And that is so, so difficult and devastating. And I wonder if you think your husband, your ex-husband, knew that that's how you felt at the time.
Oh, Mona, look, you know, there's always the before and after. At the time, I was quite sure he knew, quite sure, because, you know, I wasn't in a good place, and I couldn't think straight, and I was just full of emotion and no logic. Now I can look back and say, I really don't think he knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And when I say he betrayed me, I don't even, I'm still uncomfortable with that word. And to be honest with you, because of his alexithymia, I'm not, and because I can't put myself into his brain, I don't really know what he was thinking, and I'm not sure I ever will.
I understand, because the end of my marriage happened because of something that happened when I was in the emergency room. I thought I was having a heart attack. And the way my ex-husband, husband at the time, treated me was the last straw. It was betrayal beyond anything he had ever done to me. And I didn't know if I could ever forgive him, even though he did apologize the next day. But, when we are emotionally dysregulated and our partners are emotionally dysregulated, we're both a mess. And we say things and do things that we may not even remember, but the hurt is still there. And sometimes the hurt is a betrayal. Sometimes it's, nastiness, saying things about the other person that are just absolutely horrible, doing things that we can't take back. And, I hope that for the listeners who either have gone through something like this or are afraid that they might in the future because things that have happened could lead to this, that this will be like a word of caution that it's time to get help and to figure out how you can heal your trauma with the help of a coach or a therapist or a counselor who understands
You've
trauma.
nailed it. It's got to be understand it. And it's got to be, understands that it can be really bad and that you need a lot of help and that you're not very, I wasn't logical at that time. Clearly, I wasn't logical. I couldn't. I was traumatized. And I couldn't be logical. I was doing my best.
And so what was happening with your nervous system and your
Oh,
physical health? Where were you then?
okay. Here's the messiness. I'm not going to tell the listeners everything because it's not appropriate. But what I'm going to say is, I think that my trauma was about as bad as it could possibly be. And during those years, there was some, terrible events, terrible. I don't want to go into them, but I think it was about as bad as it could be. And what happened was that I was flooded with stress hormones. I could not emotionally regulate. I was using alcohol to dull my pain, which seemed like a very good idea at the time, and for a while it was. Except that, well, I'm not going to go into the whole drug thing, but alcohol basically doesn't work. I'm actually sober now, but I was using a lot of
Congratulations.
alcohol. Thanks, honey. I was using a lot of alcohol at the time, and from the outside, it absolutely looked like I was causing all of the problems because I, like you, I was screaming, yelling, crying, hitting my head on the wall, very, 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 very distressed. And my husband, bless his heart, from the outside, was always cool and calm. Now, I do not for 1 minute think he was cool and calm on the inside. I suspect he was maybe equally distressed, but I'll never know.
I hear you.
So the trauma played out in fairly predictable ways. I had quite significant memory and attention problems. I couldn't remember when events happened. Events became really confusing. People would ask me about what happened, and I just couldn't tell them. It was like my memory had dropped out. I became chronically irritable. My former husband just had to look at me sideways and I would explode. And I mean, literally look at me sideways and I would explode. And I had chronic sleep problems. I was up and down and up and down, up and down all night and, really unsettled. And then not long after that, I suffered 18 months of really quite chronic physical health problems. And it started one day for no particular reason, just feeling unwell. And I thought, I've got a virus, go to bed and rest it up. But it got worse and worse and worse. And I developed 13 different neurological symptoms. And my mum had MS, and I became convinced that I had MS because I lost my vision. I couldn't drive. There were some days I couldn't walk. It was quite severe, and I started to see a neurologist, and he did all of the usual tests, lumbar punctures, and MRIs, and all the rest of it. And he thought it was MS, and eventually nothing was found. But I was really unwell. There was days when I had to crawl around the house,
Wow.
And after 18 months, they disappeared. Now, looking back, I think that it was just more this chronic trauma that made me so unwell. And now I'm, you know, I swim a kilometre a day. I'm incredibly physically well, but this ill health just came upon me one day and left 18 months later.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. And, you know, the book you mentioned is such an important seminal piece of work. You know, the body keeps the score. The more we understand about trauma, the more we see the connection between, you know, our emotional health and our physical health. And, you know, you can't deny it. And I know I have folks that have come to my support groups who've talked about getting cancer or being diagnosed with cancer, autoimmune diseases. And this goes for both partners. But, you know, when you are not aware of your own neurotype and your partner's neurotype, and you don't understand really the trauma you're oftentimes causing each other, it can relate in, it can occur, I can't even talk, it can become a really challenging situation emotionally and physically for both partners. Yeah.
You know, we were converting our house for me to be in a wheelchair. That's how bad it was, which is amazing for someone who swam a kilometre this morning, and I'm incredibly fit now.
Yeah. So how long ago was that, Jill, that you had that 18 months of chronicle?
4 years ago.
Okay. So.
Yeah. Whilst we were still living together. Okay. Not that long ago.
Wow.
Fascinating, really.
It's amazing what happens to our bodies when we're so unhealthy in life or in relationships or work or family situations that are so unhealthy. Yeah. So I think, you know, and I want to tell folks that, you know, Jill does coaching with folks all over the world, and we're going to talk about that at the end. But I know you began your healing process, and did you know, after you had experienced all these physical health problems, what you needed to do to begin your healing process?
Well, I'm an avid reader, mm-hmm. and I wasn't getting the answers from anyone else. So I kind of figured out that I needed to work it out on my own. I mean, this is, you know, a while ago, and there wasn't nearly as much help for people like me then. You know, we've come so far in the last 5 years. My goodness, we've come a long way.
I
started reading. I was sure that it was chronic interpersonal trauma, and I was sure that I knew what had caused it. And when I left, and this is a pretty big thing to say, I realized that I could either choose to die, which would have been quite easy, or that I was going to survive really for my family's sake. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thank goodness I chose to survive, and eventually I survived, but it took a lot of effort, Mona.
Yeah.
And I had to put everything I had into healing, but it worked.
Yeah.
It worked.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I hear you.
I hear you, Jill.
Yeah.
And I, you know, Bessel's book, I probably found the easiest to use, and I tread it like a bit of a Bible, and I did everything that he suggested. You know, so I did the yoga and the dance and the mindfulness, and I did them all, mm-hmm. not knowing which one was going to really help. So I've listed them here. I got into mindfulness in a big time. I did a lot of training, and I mean a lot of. I went to Thailand 3 times. And did 42 days of mindfulness and meditation, and really found out not just how to do that, but learnt to practice. And I'm now quite mindful. I watch my mind. I watch the monkey in my mind taking over and misbehaving. Mm-hmm. And I'm able to pull it back and say, that's just not true. Go away, bad monkey. And I'm able to, you know, look around me and look at the trees and look at the sky and bring myself back to the present moment quite quickly. Now, I can teach anyone how to be mindful and meditate in 5 minutes, but it actually takes a long time to practice the skill and to be aware that you need to use those skills when you're in a bad moment.
Absolutely.
So do it, but it takes a long time.
Yeah, and let's talk about that for a second, because anybody that's listening that's shaking their head and saying, I can totally relate to what Jill and Mona are talking about, I will tell you that you can read all the books and you can listen to all the podcasts about mindfulness and meditation, and you're still going to get triggered. You can practice it, many hours a day, every day of the week, and you're still going to get triggered. The difference is, or you're still going to get, dysregulated. It's still going to happen. The difference for me, Jill, and I'd love to hear what you think and how this impacted you, is when I get triggered or when I become emotionally dysregulated, I look in the mirror. And I not literally look in the mirror, but I look at myself, or I think to myself, what do I need right now? Because I know I'm not feeling well about this particular situation, about this conversation, about the way this project is going. What do I need to self-soothe? And sometimes I get on my, gym clothes and I go to the gym. Sometimes I go for a walk. Sometimes I go on the front porch and I read. Sometimes I turn on Netflix. Not as often now do I reach out and call somebody. In the past, I used to do that. But whatever it is that I know I need, whatever is in my toolbox, because I definitely have a toolbox now, I pull the right thing out. And sometimes within seconds, sometimes it takes minutes. It depends. I can self-soothe and regulate myself. But I know, Jill, for me, oh my gosh, it could take days sometimes because of the emotional pain that I had. What about you? What do you feel? What's
So
your...
it took me a long time to learn to meditate and be mindful.
Okay.
Years, and I'm still getting better at it. But I've now generally within 10 or 15 minutes, I've realized what's going on. And I do really simple things like I just stop and I count. So I don't have to leave the room, leave the house, and I just count and I focus on I'm here, I'm in the room, I'm safe. There's nothing bad actually happening at the moment, you know. And I look around and I say, well, there's nothing bad happening. Come on, why is your mind playing these tricks on you? And I do simple things like just counting or looking around the room and looking at the floor rug and looking at the tablecloth and concentrating on the here and now so that it brings me back to the here and now. And in the here and now, there are generally very few problems.
Yeah.
Mostly in my world, when I bring myself back to the here and now, the world's good.
Yeah.
But
That's beautiful.
my mind's run away from itself. But it took me a long time to learn that. But you know, even if you're not in a neurodiverse relationship and traumatized, mindfulness and that is a good
Meditation.
skill. It's a good skill. And I think kids in school should be taught it.
I agree. In fact, in the United States, we do have a lot of schools where that is taught, which is phenomenal. So those kids are going to be way better if they are able to practice it in their daily life. They're going to be much more emotionally mature than those of us that never had access to this. So yeah, that's really great. And what about self-care? What do you do for
Well, you know, I used to ramble on about how I was good at self-care. Well, obviously, I wasn't good at self-care at all. And I actually learned how indulgent I had to be to self-care. And that's a hard word for me to say. I had to be indulgent. I had to prioritize myself and self-love. And I remember a psychologist I was seeing once said to me, tell yourself the things you need to hear. Do to yourself the things that you need to feel. And I learned to hug myself. I learned to hug myself and tell the things that I wanted to hear from other people. So I would hug myself and keep hugging and keep hugging and keep stroking and stroke my hair. And I'd say things like, you know, you're beautiful, Jill. You're a beautiful person. I really love you. You've got so many good qualities. You're a kind person. you know, I love you, Jill. And I would say to myself all the things that I wanted to hear other people saying to me. And through this, I learned I didn't have to rely upon other people. I could pick that up when I was really distressed at 2 o'clock in the middle of the night, hug myself and say, Jill, you're doing a great job. You're a gorgeous girl. Keep it up. You're fantastic. All those really egocentric things that I could never say before, but they were helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
They were egocentric and but not really. You know, if you can't get other people to tell you those things, hug yourself and tell yourself how wonderful you are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And eventually you believe it. I mean, you know, there's a psychotherapist that talks about, you know, we tell ourselves lies. Tell yourself a better lie. So if you tell yourself you're unworthy and you tell yourself you're not, you know, good looking and you're not somebody that deserves to be in a relationship, and whatever lies you're telling yourself, turn it around to something positive. Eventually, maybe you'll start believing the other things that you're telling yourself and they won't be lies anymore. But yeah, we're really comfortable saying negative things to ourselves and, you know, letting that monkey go crazy in our minds, right?
Yeah. So self-care is a lot more than what, I mean, I used to talk to my clients about self-care, but now I realize self-care is big time self-care. It's devoting yourself to yourself.
Yeah.
All of the time.
Yeah.
And how, and so the other things I did was I became sober. I'm not going to talk too much about that, but pretty damn proud of it. And that wasn't easy. I put a lot of effort into gratitude. Probably the thing I put most effort into was positive relationships. Now, this, Mona, was difficult because on a certain level, I was angry with my family on a certain level. But I needed their emotional safety. I needed to feel safe in a family who I loved, but I was still angry with them. It's like, well, how? So I realized that I needed to do something different. No one else was going to do it for me. So I decided to apologize and forgive my husband completely. Completely. Now, that took a lot of effort because there was still anger there. But I wrote and wrote and wrote and apologized for everything that I could think that I'd done wrong. And there was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was a lot. And to completely forgive him.
And did you send it in writing?
Okay. Yeah. And so, you know, for better or for worse, I sent it on our 40th wedding anniversary, or what would have been. So it's very emotional.
Sure.
But I don't know what effect it had on my former husband. But it had a wonderful effect of freeing me.
That's
of
beautiful.
Freeing me, of letting go of my hurt.
And, so healing, Jill. Let's just talk about that for a minute, because I think oftentimes people think that somebody else has to forgive or somebody else has to apologize for us to heal. And it's wonderful if you can get that. And, you know, there's lots of wonderful books out there that talk about the way to apologize and what kind of apologies you need and how to forgive. I mean, you could just Google it and there's lots out there. But you may never get what you think you need. So whatever you have to do to close that loop is critical, because I do think that if we're holding on to resentment and we're not able to forgive and we're not able to apologize for the things that we did to unintentionally, or sometimes, you know, people have intentionally hurt somebody they love, if we're not able to apologize, even if that apology is never sent, that can be so healing for us, and it can help us close that loop and close that door. So I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that. I just wanted to share that, because
well, the apologies never did come, and I'm not angry about that. I'm not angry. I'm understanding that really my family never saw my situation from my perspective. Mm-hmm. And so what did they have to apologize for? But I'm okay with that now. And I closed the gap by apologizing and forgiving. And when I did that, I found I was able to move towards them and be more comfortable and ask for their love, whereas there was too much anger to ask for their love before.
Yeah, I think that's really important. The anger piece, I mean, it can eat you up. And that's why I do think a lot of people who hold on to that anger and resentment get sick, whether it's emotional or physical or both. For me, one of the most healing things was to go to a somatic therapist. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely kind of thank her for helping me understand what I needed to let go that was still stuck in my body, literally mm-hmm. stuck in my
yep.
body.
Yep.
So for those of you that are interested in finding a somatic therapist, I highly recommend, it's called Somatic Experiencing. I think that's the website. It's Dr. Peter Levine. And yep. that's where I found my somatic therapist. It was just life-changing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And was that a talking therapy?
Yes, it was talking, but it was also feeling, like when we were talking about whatever it was that I was emotional about or feeling some anxiety about, she's like, how are you feeling when you say that? Where are you feeling that? And then we would work through it together. And it was some relaxation techniques and things like that. So I'm glad you asked. Yeah, it was a little bit of both. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mona, I'm jumping ahead a bit of my notes here, but I read The Body Keeps the Score mm-hmm. many, many, many times, and I just decided he was a pretty good bloke, this Bessel, and he knew what he was talking about. He's brilliant.
Yes.
You know, hope he hears this, but his book is fantastic, and I suggest your readers listen to it. It's a long book, but it's good. It's really good.
It's fantastic. If you haven't read it and you're in a neurodiverse relationship, no matter what your neurotype is, I highly recommend it. The things that he talks about, all the techniques that he's used, the research that he shares, the results of the research, how people's lives have changed, is just, it's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. Yeah.
Yeah. So I followed that book and I tried to do everything in that book that he suggested. And I got to chapter 15, and chapter 15 is called Letting Go of the Past, and it's about EMDR. Now, when I looked on your website a few weeks ago thinking about what was I going to talk about, I put in EMDR and it didn't come up. Have any of your speakers spoken about EMDR?
Not in any detail at all. If it's been mentioned, it's been like a blip. Yeah. So I'd love for you to share what you went through and how that helped you. Yeah.
Look, I'd like to, because I think it was probably my most healing therapy.
Mm. Yeah. I'd love to hear that.
All of those things I did, I think it was the most effective. So let me first tell you. So Bessel talks about it a lot. Chapter 15 is the one to go to, and it's called Letting Go of the Past. And I thought, wow, I really want to let go of the past. I want to let go and move on. So what I'm not an EMDR therapist, so I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes reading out something from the EMDR Association of Australia, because I'm a client, not a therapist. Can I do that?
Yes, absolutely.
It's just short. So eye movement, this is what EMDR is, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy is based on the idea that negative thoughts, feelings and behaviours are the result of unprocessed memories from unpleasant experiences, hence my trauma. That made sense. The treatment involves standardized procedures that include focusing simultaneously on spontaneous associations of traumatic images. In other words, thinking about your trauma, not talking, thinking about your trauma. And at the same time, and this sounds like quackery, bilateral stimulation of eye movements. Now, when I read this, and I can ramble on as an authentic person, but I'm also fairly academic as well. I just thought, oh yeah, this sounds a bit wacko. But then I thought, well, if Bessel's recommending it, I'm going to give it a go. So I gave it a go. And what I did was I found an EMDR psychologist. He was a young guy, lovely guy, lovely, lovely guy. Didn't know anything about neurodiverse relationships. Don't think he knew a great deal about autism, but he was an EMDR trained specialist. And I just went in there thinking, if Bessel says it's a good idea, I'm going to do it.
Okay.
Now, the explanation I've given you to me just sounds complicated, but this is how I describe it to my clients. So I say to my clients, and I'm no neurosurgeon, so this is pretty rough. And people will say, no, that's not true. That's not what happens. But this is how I describe it. So I say, neurons move messages from an A to B road in our brain. My A to B message was, my husband didn't love me. And this A to B road or message became thick, hot, quick to react and extremely painful as it was triggered and reinforced at least several times a day.
Wow.
Which is why I think when my husband looked at me sideways, my A to B neuron road just exploded for no good reason other than that it was thick and hot and painful.
Yeah.
But go on.
Yeah, and I think... You know, this is really powerful because the stories we tell ourselves become our reality. And the story you told yourself was that your husband, your former husband, didn't love you. And that was probably so far from the truth. And we do this in, you know, a lot of our relationships. We tell ourselves stories that aren't true, because we have childhood wounds, we have trauma, we have issues from our family of origin that we haven't healed and we don't know it. And so I think it's really important to think about the stories that we're telling ourselves about ourselves and our partners and look at whether or not we have, you know, proof that that is actually true. Because in a neurodiverse relationship, Jill, we know that our partners aren't going to communicate with us the way that we necessarily communicate, and then we see them as wrong or we see them as bad. And again, this is for all neurotypes. You know, we may have very different ways of handling emotions and processing emotions or even understanding emotions. There may be sensory differences, socializing differences. And so we judge our partners. We create stories in our head about them and us as a couple, and it creates so much, again, unintentional hurt and pain and oftentimes toxicity.
Yeah, yeah. And it had actually affected my neurology. So it had created this road that every time I thought about it, triggered my trauma and made me feel extreme pain.
Sure. And so how did EMDR help you? Okay. And if you don't mind sharing how many sessions you actually went to, that would be also helpful.
How it helped was that before I went to EMDR therapy, I had to know what was going on. It's no good for your listeners, I don't believe, to go to EMDR therapy straight up without having a really good understanding of what's gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so before I went to EMDR, I knew that it wasn't that my husband didn't love me. I had already worked out that the problem was my husband couldn't see things from my perspective. Now,
So good.
I had to know that before I went to EMDR. So when I went to EMDR, what I was able to do is I was able to create a new road in my brain, and I call it the A to C road. And the ATC road was A to C. My husband couldn't see things from my perspective.
And
And what
how long did it take you to get to that, to change that?
about one session.
Okay, isn't that amazing? It is
Un
so
un
amazing.
unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And I have several friends that are EMDR practitioners. And when they first went for the training, I want to say it was close to 6 years ago. I was in shock when they started to tell me stories about how in one or two sessions people had more progress and healing than in years of talk therapy.
I definitely had more healing in one or two sessions than 20 years of talk therapy.
Wow. Wow.
And the interesting thing is that, I only spent about 10 minutes telling this psychologist my story because he actually didn't need to know it. It wasn't important that he knew my story, but only I needed to know my story.
Yeah. So
So
you're not re-traumatizing yourself by
No,
having to
no,
tell your
no,
story
no.
over and over again.
Initially, when I at the beginning of the session, I would become teary. The tears would flow when I would think about my initial feeling, which was my husband doesn't love me. But the process was really moving me, or moving my brain neurologically from my husband doesn't love me to my husband couldn't see my point of view. And what, although there was some improvement over one session, I actually had 10, and by the end of 10, I was such a different person. It had kind of cemented into my brain that the A to B road was a wrong one, and the A to C road was the correct one. And it had, I guess, desensitized and reprocessed my brain.
Yeah, you created new neural pathways, and that's what I know Bessel talks about. And maybe there are some people that can do that on their own, but I think for a lot of people, it takes a professional to help with that, whether it's EMDR or some other kind of therapeutic modality. But I think that is wonderful that you were able to get to that place as part of your healing journey, and that you found Bessel's book, and that you found a good EMDR practitioner who was able to get you to the point where now you're able to provide coaching to others who might be going through something similar. So, can you share a little bit about your work as a neurodiverse coach or a coach for neurodiverse individuals and couples?
Yeah, so we were talking about this the other day. I have a master's of counselling, and in Australia it's a little bit different. I can practice all over Australia, and I do. There's no problems with licensing, and I can call myself a coach or a counsellor or a therapist. I've got a master of counselling. It doesn't matter, so it's not really an issue. I definitely got into the work for the same reason as everyone else. It was part of my healing, and I don't mind saying that. It became my purpose, my love, my passion. It fills me with joy. And every time I have a client, it's good for me and it's good for them, and I just love it. So,
That's awesome.
and I guess, quite simply, I counsel couples or individuals using the things that I learned, basically. I learned the hard way. So I spend the first session offering my clients some really, I used to be a teacher, so I think I have a fairly simple way of explaining things. So I try and explain to them as simply as possible about their different neurologies and understanding that the root cause of their problems is related to neurology. Not, we don't love each other, we don't care about each other enough, we're not trying hard enough.
That's beautiful.
And that session's big, and it's important that people by the end of that first session have got, this has got to do with different neurologies.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second session, I go straight into trauma because, and this is my belief, Mona, and I'm going right there and saying it, but I believe that most of my couples, both neurodiverse and neurotypical, are traumatized to some degree.
Yeah.
To some degree.
And do you think they're traumatized in the relationship, or do you think it's relational trauma and trauma from maybe their family of origin, or do you just focus on the relational trauma?
Both. Often,
okay.
Often from family of origin, and I ask
okay.
about that, which, you know, I'm sure lots of your speakers have talked about the relationship between family of origin trauma and primary relationship trauma, so we explore that. A lot of people don't, a lot of my clients don't really like using the word trauma. Maybe I've just got too comfortable with it. It's a big word. But that's the direction that I go in, that we're working towards the idea that they're suffering some sort of trauma, either from childhood or from their current primary relationship. And certainly if they don't want to use the word trauma, it's extreme distress.
Sure.
And, you know, a huge amount of my clients arrived at that first session very traumatized.
Yeah.
Very, and it's upsetting. I've got a lot better at it now because I realize after 6 years of doing this specific work, that's what's going on. I used to take it more personally in the beginning, but now I just see that they're traumatized and try to explain to them what's going on. And I find the process of them understanding what's happened to them is quite a big part of the healing. When you get what's happened and why it's happened and when it's gone so badly, to me, the healing has started.
Yeah. I think not only has there probably been relational trauma and trauma from, you know, family of origin and just growing up and things that they didn't understand, both partners, but also I think that there's a lot of shame, and I haven't talked a great deal about it on the podcast, but I've heard a lot of folks in the support groups that I facilitate talk about their shame. And, you know, I had some shame from all the screaming I did in my relationship.
Yeah.
And I did it because I didn't know how to regulate my nervous system. I didn't know
yeah.
what was triggering me. And I never, ever, ever want to hurt somebody that I love, ever. And
no.
yet I did it. And
yeah.
I had guilt and I had shame and I had to heal that. So I think, you know, sharing honestly that we all have things that we wish we had done differently, and we have the opportunity to heal ourselves. And if we choose to stay in our relationships, we have an opportunity to heal with our partners, I think is life-changing. So what would you say happens as you help clients or couples understand kind of the trauma cycle? What does that look like for folks that are interested to know?
So I have to give Harry Motrow some credit here. In fact, quite a lot of credit. In fact, Harry, if you hear this, a huge amount of credit. I listened to Harry, please forgive me, because like all good ideas, I've pinched some of them. Harry, I heard for the first time on your conference last year, and he gave a great talk. And if you go back into his website, which is actually very similar to mine, Harry, I didn't pinch your site. I bought it 6 years ago. Please forgive me. he talks about a neurodiverse couple's trauma cycle, and it's a picture of a circle. And I turned it into a coaching card. I turned it into words and steps. And I'll just read it out pretty quickly. And when I show my couples this trauma cycle, most of them go, yep, that's what happened to us. Mm-hmm. And the pain drops immediately because they go, oh, it happened to other people too. So it wasn't just me being a nasty person or them being a nasty person. This is what happens with neurodiverse couples. So number one is, and everyone here listening will know it, the post-honeymoon phase cycle starts where everything is fantastic. Been there, done that. And then the neurotypical prisms, unless it's these days when their partner is diagnosed, but certainly in my days, presumes that their partner's neurotypical and places unintended daily pressures on the neurodiverse partner to be neurotypical. You know, I expected my husband to sit and watch TV with me after dinner. He thought that it was okay after dinner for him to go off for the rest of the night and do his own thing. I didn't. It was all unintended. And right. he tried really, really hard for a long time to change his nighttime behaviours and spend time with me. But what happened was that he started to become distressed because he was spending too long with this very emotional girl who wanted to talk to him all night. Poor man.
That sounds like my marriage.
Poor man. Yeah. And he really quite distressed. Mm-hmm. And after a while started to withdraw and escape to his special interests more and more. So the more pressure I put on him to spend time with me, the more he needed to escape. Yep. And then the old Cassandra syndrome, trauma, OTRS, whatever you want to call it, hit in with me, the pain, the loneliness, the feeling gaslighted, the emotional flooding, all of it started to set in. And then he shut down even more and stopped talking to me, which really didn't help, but that was his way of dealing with it. He started, now he tells me, to feel like a failure in his marriage and that he, you know, was a failure as a person. So sad.
Yeah.
So sad. And for me, my anxiety, my depression, my distrust, my feelings of neglect, abandonment, intense loneliness, hopelessness, confusion, frustration, feeling detached, insecure, unsafe, they all came in with a bang. Mm-hmm. And these are Harry's words, reactivity has become the new primary problem. So it wasn't the neurodiversity that was the primary problem anymore. It was the fact that I was continually reacting and we could no longer have rational conversations with each other.
Yep. I can relate, Jill.
Sucks.
It sucks big time. And I guarantee you a lot of the listeners are going, you're describing my communication in my relationship. And all I want to say is if you want to continue in the relationship, there is hope. There is hope.
There is. And if you understand that trauma cycle, that was so helpful for us that we weren't bad people trying to do each other in. We were just both not understanding each other. And if your listeners get a chance, go back to, I think it's on Harry's website, Neurodiverse Couple Counseling with the 1L. You can actually see that picture, that circle with the split up into triangles. It's very good.
I think it is. That's where it is. I'll put the link for his website in
the show notes.
Yeah.
So second or sometimes third session, we focus on trauma. Because this is my experience, I've got to say, trauma was a huge part of what went wrong for us. And I understand it, I feel it, I empathize with it, and I've physically had to go through all of the steps to heal. And I did. I healed. I think I'm nearly there. Maybe I am. Yeah. So I use all the things that I learned in my trauma and my healing with my clients.
That's wonderful.
Basically, which in some ways makes the job quite easy because I don't have to read too many academic lardy-dars. I just remember what happened and remember what I did and say, well, maybe you could try this because it worked for me.
Sure. And so as we're ending, the podcast, I'd love for you to kind of wrap up what you do, what else you do to help couples get to the next kind of stage so they don't keep repeating this cycle.
Well, so Jen, I have a pattern. Generally, we have about three sessions together. We do one on understanding neurology, a couple on trauma, and starting the reducing the trauma cycle. And then I generally suggest that they go off to see someone else to get some EMDR. I could train as an EMDR therapist, but that's not my specialty, and someone much cheaper than me can do it. So I send them away, they come back in a much better place, and then we just do a lot of psychoeducation. And I think being a teacher has helped me to do this. I've developed fairly easy ways of explaining things to people. I used to be a teacher of teachers who teach autism. So before I was a counselor, I was a teacher. So I'm fairly good at kitsch ways of teaching people things. And something my husband and I did before we separated, and this was purely his idea, he came up with the idea of coaching cards. And the coaching cards was because he said the bleeding obvious. People with autism don't like coming to counselling. Period. I knew that, but I didn't know what to do. And he said, well, why don't you send them out either before or after visual copies of what you're going to talk about? So we, as a couple, started to come up with these coaching cards. And they were things that we used to use in our relationship to try and fix our dysfunctional communication problems. So step one was you do this, step two was I do that, step three you do this, step four da 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 da. And we wrote them down in a really easy to use format. And now I send out the coaching cards either before or after to get couples to practice certain skills at home. And they can download them onto their phones. And I say, when you're in conflict, get your phones out and follow step one, step two, step three, step four, step five. And they work.
I love
They're
it.
really good.
I love it. I love it. And that's why I created the Neurodiverse Love Conversation cards, I don't know, 2 years ago, because I made a list of all the questions that I wished my ex and I had asked each other. And if we had asked each other those questions at the beginning of our marriage, we would have avoided so much unintentional hurt and pain. And yeah, and I use a workbook for the Neurodiverse Couple Support Group that I facilitate. I have not made it available for sale yet, but I hope to one day. And it includes, 12 steps or routes, and it explains each one of them because, there's always a visual thinker or processor in, or there usually is in the relationship, and then there's somebody who
My
wants to talk
husband,
it through.
he was great with
Right.
that.
Yeah.
He was
So
great.
it allows everybody to learn differently, and hopefully get to mastering the skills that they feel and their partner feels are most important for them to be in a healthy relationship. And I think one of the things, Jill, we talked about was how important it is for the autistic or neurodivergent partner to understand or to get to a place where they feel emotionally safe enough to be their authentic selves. I think it's important for both partners. But the masking piece, and I'm going to just say this from my own marriage, I do believe that my ex-husband masked for 29 years. I
It's a long
believe he
time.
masked for our entire marriage. And I don't think, we've never talked about this. I don't think he was aware of it. And I think that the autistic or neurodivergent partner may mask because they don't want to hurt their partner. He was a shutdowner. And masking with your partner does not allow them to know who you really are. And so when you start to unmask, that could create a lot of challenges because your partner is trying to adjust or trying to understand how things have changed or why things are changing. So I think you both have to have some grace and patience for each other as you both become your more authentic selves in this healing and growing process. So I don't know if you have anything to add to that. And then,
Yeah, I do.
yeah,
So
okay.
I was at a conference a long, long time ago with Tony Atwood in Sydney, and he was talking to one of the conference participants, and he said something that was golden. He said, "Be a good Aspie, not a bad neurotypical." And which was, to a neurotypical makes perfect sense. Like, why would you want a mask? Because I love you as you are. But that's obviously not the case, because my husband, bless his heart, still to this day, still finds it really difficult not to mask. And I don't know if that'll ever change. And I can't put himself into my head and understand why he does it, because I think I love him for exactly who he is. And I adore him. I think he's the most fantastic person. But I don't know if that's going to ever happen. And I don't know the answer to how to get people who are 50 when they're diagnosed to stop masking. But, to the younger couples who I work with, that doesn't seem to be happening. They seem to be coming in saying, I'm an Aspie and I'm proud of it.
I love that.
Maybe things will get better in the future with the younger generation. But I feel so sad for people like my ex. Because in so many ways it was too late. He'd been masking for too long, and it was too frightening for him to let go.
Yeah, I think that's the case for a lot of folks in what we call the lost generation. And those are folks that, grew up at a time where there wasn't awareness of autism and ADHD the way there is today. Of course, we didn't have social media and all these things. So I think the younger generation is more open about their sharing their neurodivergency and understanding each other's differences. And I love that. I love it. So I know we have talked about so many things, Jill, that are going to be so helpful and important to the listeners. So I would like to wrap up with you sharing your final thoughts and then you sharing your contact information for the folks that want to contact you because you're a coach and you work with people all over the world.
Coach, counselor, therapist, whatever you want. I'm licensed to do, and I'm a teacher. I was a teacher for 20 years, so
Right, but the
licensed.
license is just for Australia. Yeah.
No, I can teach anywhere around the world, but I choose not to because of insurance issues and time issues.
Right, but
Makes sense. It's
I just want a lot of people don't understand the difference between a coach and a counselor. So you have a license to do counseling in Australia.
I've got a Master of Counsel. I've got a license to counsel anywhere in Australia.
Yeah, that's right. And so but you can do coaching with people all over the world. That's what I want folks to
Yeah,
know.
I'm never quite sure what. No, I can do. No, I can work as a counselor. Maybe not in a. I don't know about America. I'm not quite sure about that. I still don't really understand it, to be honest with you, Mona.
Yeah, you have to be licensed in the state
Okay.
where the person is to be able to do therapy and counseling. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
So maybe I
yeah.
can be a coach, but to be honest with you, we've got a lot of work here still to do in Australia, and you guys have got lots and lots of people working in this area, a lot more than we do in Australia.
Yeah. So tell the folks what your last thoughts or words of wisdom are, and then how they can contact you, Jill.
So I've already told them, firstly, there is hope. Lack of understanding is a disaster. Find someone who knows what they're talking about, preferably someone who's experienced it. I know we're often more expensive, but a lot of my clients make huge improvements in 3 to 4 sessions. Huge. They go out, laughing and smiling and hugging each other and saying, "We're back in the same bed again at night."
That's awesome.
So I think you find someone who knows what they're doing. I can push people down that positive track a lot quicker than fluffing around the edges.
Yeah. I think that's important. So if
Yeah.
they want to work with you, what is the best way for them to reach you and contact
Okay, so I changed my website this week. It's been a big week.
you?
I bought two websites 6 years ago. So I'm formerly known as autismcoaching.com, but because of NDIS in Australia and there being a lot of autism coaching, which is really life coaching for people with autism, a lot of people who are looking for something else are hitting my site. So I went back to the other site that I bought 5 or 6 years ago, and it's just neurodiverse couples counseling, counseling with two L's,
Okay.
because that's what we do in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
And then it's .com.au. So it's specifically Australia.
Okay.
Neurodiverse couples counseling with two L's, .com.au.
Perfect. And I'll put that in the show notes.
Thanks,
So,
Amanda.
yeah, absolutely. Jill, this has been a phenomenal discussion, conversation, and I know we talked about a lot of things that we both experienced that I know others are going to resonate with. And I
Hope
just
so.
want to end by saying that whether you're the non-autistic, neurotypical, holistic, whatever word you use to describe yourself, or you're the autistic or autistic ADHD partner in a relationship, there is hope. There are people that can help you heal individually and as a couple if you decide that you want to go down that path. And I always tell folks I have a list of people who have been on the Neurodiverse Love podcast who do this work all over the world. You can go to my website, neurodiverselove.com, and find that. And I will be adding Jill to that list. And I hope that people who listen to your story and the information that I shared. Know they're not alone and find the resources that can help them move forward and not just survive, but one day heal, grow, and thrive.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful,
Yeah. So
beautiful.
thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your journey. Thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for sharing a little bit about your expertise, and I love your coaching cards, and I think they're just fabulous. So folks that work with Jill will have an opportunity to get some of her coaching cards. I think it's
One day, I
terrific.
know you've encouraged me to sell them. I'm thinking about it. I'm
Okay.
thinking about it.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Jill. I really, really appreciate you being on the podcast today.
Mona, you are wonderful, and you have done so much for so many people around the world. Thank you.
Thanks. I
Keep
really appreciate
going, girl. Keep going.
it. Yes, absolutely.